The following workshop was recorded at the 7th Annual Pittsburgh Classical Christian Education Conference. For more information about the conference, visit the Blackburn Study Center website at www.blackburnstudycenter.org.
My wife and I are going to share the responsibility of doing the talking in this time frame. If you have a handout, well, you'll want to have a handout, which is a segment from the Omnibus curriculum. You don't have an outline, I don't think, the outline I'm working from. If you would like that, we can arrange to have copies made of it. I'm going to cover some general things, and she's going to walk you through that handout with some specifics, and then we'll come back to a more a broad overview, principled kind of discussion at the end that I will speak to, and then we'll allow considerable time for questions and answers and interaction in that way. How many of you have had a chance before this moment to see the Omnibus textbook that we've published? Let me put it another way. How many have not? Okay, so it's really pretty close to half and half. I want to give you a little bit of background as to how we got to this point. Now, this is in the speaking I've done in the first 2 hours, I've been speaking primarily about methods and classical education in general, and I try not to do any shameless promotional marketing, but in this hour, it's going to be unavoidable. So I'm sorry if you think this is an infomercial. I'll try my best to not make it any more than necessary, but there are just some aspects of this discussion that have to be that way. In the spring of 1999, we gathered a number of people together for what we called a dialectic symposium. What we were trying to do there was discuss what a secondary education in classical Christian education ought to look like in a number of different ways and a number of different aspects. It's wonderful to talk, as I did in the first hour, about all this philosophical stuff and to sit back and think, man, I'd love to have an education like that. I'd love to be able to be a student like that. I'd love to be able to teach my kids like that. And then comes Monday morning at 8 o'clock, and you say, now, what is it I'm supposed to do right now? It doesn't necessarily connect just because we're excited. We need a plan. We need a process, and that's what we were trying to do at that moment. It was primarily driven by what we were doing at that time at Veritas Academy and what we wanted to do, and it's probably important to point out that Veritas Academy and Veritas Press are not formally related. Veritas Press is a for-profit business owned by my wife and me, and Veritas Academy is a charitable nonprofit institution run by a board of which I'm one board member. So they're not connected formally in any way. Now, does one influence the other, and do are there informal connections? Well, certainly, and those should be obvious, but I wanted you to understand that. So now we're doing that, and in having this meeting, and it was a wonderful time, and it benefited us more than we realized it would. And what it helped us understand in a far clearer way was a distinction between the education that we've grown accustomed to from our experience and that which would have been the case previously. And I'm specifically referring to the separation of disciplines versus recognizing theology being queen of the sciences and that wheel analogy that I used earlier. Here are a couple of the conclusions that we had of the symposium, and these are some things that I've mentioned before, and I'm trying to be careful to repeat myself where it's important to the point, but not repeat myself such that if you've heard me for this will be the third straight hour that you've heard me, that you're tired of hearing the same thing. But you have to realize that not everybody has been here, so understanding there. One of the things that we concluded is that the dialectic and rhetoric stages are not as different from each other as the grammar stage is from those stages. Okay, so the grammar stage, we could almost look at it with the grammar stage being here and the dialectic stage, I'll just do it with a DS, being here, almost connected to the rhetoric stage. So there's a sense in which what we have, or you could do it with an outline, call it grammar stage and secondary stage, and then have dialectic and logic underneath it, just to kind of illustrate it in a way that would be understanding on that point. There's more of a connection between the dialectic and rhetoric than there is the grammar with either of those two. A second thing that we concluded was that the modern model, the 50-minute periods in math, 50-minute period in history, 50-minute period in science, 50-minute period in literature, whatever, this fractured model promoted a fragmented understanding of God's world and work. And we wanted to not promote, I hope it goes without saying, but anytime it goes without saying, it probably should still be said, we don't think a fragmented understanding is a good idea. We want to see and understand the connections. And so we wanted to do something about that. So we thought, we concluded from this, that integrating the disciplines that could be and should be integrated ought to become a high priority. And so we set out to try and figure out how to do that. And that was what gave birth to what we call the omnibus curriculum. Omnibus is simply a Latin term that kind of means all-encompassing. And what we're trying to say is, what is the omnibus? It's everything. Okay? Well, that's a little bit overwhelming to mention an understatement. But we really do mean that. Now, the disciplines that we're taking on initially are simply combining history, theology, and literature. And I'll get to that in just a moment. I want to give another point of background. If you've seen the movie, I think this movie goes back 5 or 6 years now, from C.S. Lewis called Shadowlands, or about C.S. Lewis called Shadowlands, you might remember C.S. Lewis sitting in his office with a group of students in a roundtable type discussion. And what I remember of that, and I'm not going to watch it again because I'm afraid that my memory is better than what actually was shown there, was that they were kind of having an open discussion that could include almost anything. In other words, it was an attempt in an English educational setting to connect disciplines. And that was part of that Oxford education that was going on there. And that's what we're talking about. These are classical models that they've been more inclined to hold on to than we have. Pragmatism, which is the only philosophical school to have been given birth on American soil, and Mann and Dewey, Mann kind of made for fertile ground, but Dewey and others were the ones that birthed it, were really responsible for some of the segregation of disciplines into the compartments that they're in. And they were motivated by thinking of education as a tool for two things: to make better citizens and to help people get a job. And so that's what they're after. That's not what we're after in classical Christian education. Now, don't read that to mean that I don't want your kids to get jobs. Okay? I'm not looking to help the unemployment rate increase. But what I do mean is that what we're after is preparing them to do and address anything and everything in a way that honors Christ and that they can succeed at. And that's what a classical education should do for us. The term liberal arts or a liberal education doesn't mean Hillary Clinton-esque. It means freeing. It's going to free us. It's going to make us a free man. And that's what we want to do for our kids. What can a kid with a classical education do, you ask? Anything he wants to, is what we want to be able to answer. That's what I mean. And so we want to see reversing the effects of pragmatism and this vocational approach to education. So in our first go-round in this omnibus curriculum, which we are calling for 7th, 8th, and 9th grades, and we're you know, this is a hardcover book. It's an expensive book to print, I can tell you. We want it to address primarily 7th, 8th, and 9th graders when they've had some background in the process. So if your kid is new to classical education at 7th grade, I'm telling you right now, this will be a challenge. Now, can you do it? Yeah. Can you do as much or as thoroughly as somebody who's come up in the system? No. Be realistic. Do what you can. And the other thing that we're doing in this first go-around in Omnibus 1, 2, and 3, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, is only trying to incorporate, at least substantially and primarily, there are some small exceptions to it, history, literature, and theology, three content-oriented disciplines. Notably absent, of course, are math. Art and music find their way into it in some interesting and fun ways. At least we hope that's what you think of them. And they come in there and do that a little bit, too. You'll also find some logic and rhetoric, primarily at this point anyway, logic overlays where there's some exercises that will enhance, drill, refine the logic learning that they have done in that discipline. And I mentioned the art and music. It's primarily about the historical appreciative aspects as opposed to learning to play or learning to sing, vocational, technical kinds of things. So this is what we have done. Now, our plan is to have, well, I'm sorry, let me hold off on that. Laurie is going to now talk really about working through the book. Have your outline handy because she's going to use that heavily to show how that process works and how it actually plays out in an educational setting.
If you're like I am, the thought of teaching the great books is a little bit overwhelming. And that was one of the reasons that we wanted to do this. And the other thing that was overwhelming to me was the last thing that I want my children to do is read pagan authors outside of the context of understanding the historical worldview. And if you're like me, you don't know that. Or at least at the point where an expert would. And so that's why we set out to find the people who would know the most about each and individual book. I have actually taught this to one of our children at home, and I can tell you it can be done without a lot of preparation. You can, you know, I don't know, I was talking to somebody earlier, and they said, but I don't get to read the books that my children are reading. How can I do this? Well, you can read the information and teach this and still be involved in your child's education without reading the entire book before your child does. Because if you're homeschooling 4 or 5 children, it's a very difficult thing to do to keep up with everything. You know, your younger children get the benefit of the fact that you've already gone through it once and you've probably read that material, but the children that are on the upper end, you're always trying to keep ahead, and you've still got dishes to take care of and things to keep clean and dinner to cook and all these other things, and it's virtually impossible. But if you read the beginning information, you will be able to do that. Every single one of the books in here, all the books that we've chosen, start off with the pattern is follows the same every time. So if you look at this first page of your handout, you're going to start off with some general information. You're always going to start out with the author and the context. We're going to tell you who the author is and the context, the world into which he lived. You know, who is he and details about him. The next thing you're going to do is go on and talk about the significance of the book. You know, that's one of the things the children always say. Why does it matter if I read this book? Well, here's your answer. We're going to, okay, I thought I had fixed it on my phone. Sorry. Okay, sorry about that. And so you're going to talk about the significance and why that's very important for them to learn. Then you're going to go on and you're going to study who the main characters are. Okay, now here are the tools. Before you start the book, and your children should read this. Let me say that. They should read this before they begin the book. Somebody said, well, isn't it kind of like having cliff notes to the book? The answer is yes. In some senses, it is. These works are difficult. I can tell you, if you have a roadmap before you begin, and when I was doing this at home, I actually took the main characters, had my child make a chart of them, so that as we were going through the book, they knew who those people were. And I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, let me just admit something. It's called technology. My children were not here this morning, and so I had no clue how to turn this off on my phone because they are not here to deal with it. Okay, that's really embarrassing, but it's true. Okay. And so find out what the story is about before you begin. Most of these works, now the primary books are typically historical or theological in nature. Your secondary books are not necessarily that way, but you're not going to really find a mystery that you're going to, you know, make the book not interesting once you find out the details about it if you read this information. And so it's important to do that. And discuss this with your child before you begin so they understand. Then the very last thing you're going to get is the worldview. And this is, you know, so important. In Herodotus, there's even charts that you're going to have. If you turn to page 222, you're going to see it actually... These charts show you exactly what was going on in biblical history as recorded in the Bible with what's recorded in Herodotus. And I can tell you, the children find that so interesting. Now it becomes something that it's not, you know, what does this have to do with Scripture? You know, it's not isolated anymore. Herodotus was writing about the same thing. That's what's so fascinating to me. I mean, so many of us think, okay, we've got the Bible and it's categorized and it's over here and this only took place during this time. And nobody else wrote about that. You can't possibly find out. And then we're going to read this other book and it might have something to do with Greek history, but those two things don't go together. And that's just not the case. I mean, Herodotus was the first historian. I mean, that fact in and of itself is enough that it should make us want to read this book just on our own. I like this book, in case you can't tell. And so, you know, get your child excited about those kind of things before they even begin. Somebody said, well, my son, and I have one of these, I said in an earlier talk, who really is not interested in this. But what I did was I had him try to figure out, he is very much into economics, I guess is a polite way to put it. And so I had him figure out there's an event in here where they're telling how much it cost to build this enormous boat and what one of the kings had given to them to try to figure this out. And so I had him try to figure that out in today's dollar, what that would be. Now, that wasn't in the book. We can't give you every idea that's going to interest your child. That probably wouldn't interest the majority of children. But I saw that quickly and was able to make that relationship. And I said to him, you know, let's take a look at this and see how that would translate to today. Then if you keep turning your pages here, you're going to get to the end of the worldview information, and you're going to go to session one. Now, the way the omnibus is set up is it gives you a session translates into a day. That is one day's work, okay? Now, let me say this. You may not get through all the work. You know, pick and choose what you're going to do. One of the things Veritas Press really, really believes in is that you're the teacher, we're not. You need to take the information you want your child to know and have them do that information. There is always, with a prelude, a question to consider. And this is one of the things that's dialectic in nature. You know, here, the beginning question is, if you were going to write a great work of history, how would you do it? What would you avoid at all cost? Now, if you've just read the prior information, the child is going to have an understanding how to answer that because the prelude questions come from the general information that's given to the child. Now, you have all the answers. They don't, but it's great. And so if you're trying to teach your child, all you need to do is read through this, have read the general information, then read through these questions, and you'll be able to help them work through that. Now, from the next thing is from the general information above, answer the following questions. Those questions just relate to the information that they have read in this book. Not in Herodotus yet. We haven't even started the book. And what I did was I had my child answer those questions on paper. You know, I would discuss with them the question to consider. I never even had them write that down. That was something I wanted to talk to them about. But then one of the things you can do is have them answer that general information, give them that assignment, so you can go off and work with another child. We're always trying to juggle things, and that's a way to do that, because that is grammatical information, the general information. And then there's always a reading assignment that's given. The reading assignments need to be done before they begin the next lesson. It's their homework, so to speak, for the next day. And then we have a variety of different sessions. And one of the things that I had my child do was, on any of the sessions, I always had them write out the text analysis questions on paper, because that was something that they could do. And the text analysis is the grammar of the story. It's factual information. It's finding out, do they understand what they read? Now, as we're transitioning children into this material, I really encourage you to read it out loud with them. Dads, this is a great way for you to get involved. Read, you know, pick a chapter, even a couple pages, and read out loud at night with your child. Because I can tell you, my husband, I think part of it's just the fact, okay, if Dad's going to read this, that it, you know, and do this with me, then I'm going to pay attention. And read it out loud with them and help them understand. And if they see you're interested in it, you know, they know, generally speaking, Mom's the one who has to do this if you're homeschooling. But, and even if you're not homeschooling, if, you know, our children are in school, when Marlon takes the time to do it with them, they know that I love books, okay? And so they just think, ah, that's Mom's thing. But if Marlon takes the time to do it with them, it really piques their interest in a different way. So read out loud with them and ask them about those questions to consider. It may, you know, those are the questions. The questions to consider are the ones that are causing them to think and put worldview issues into what they're studying. Now, there's a number of different classes. Recitation classes are basically quizzes for your children. Those are factual information. You don't have all the sessions here, but I'm going to go over them. But the recitation is pure factual information that they're getting. There are writing exercises in here that we give you. And those are the kind of things, that's, you know, I have people say to me, there is no way I can get all this writing done and all these questions and all of that. Don't do all of it. A writing assignment, I found that the writing assignment sometimes took my child 2 or 3 days to do well. You don't have to do them all well, but sometimes you want to choose to do them well, and that's okay. Instead of having them write out the factual questions, just read them out loud to them. See if they know what they are, because that's your way of knowing, did they understand this material. Then there are activities. You know, if you have other families in your area or even just one other friend that might be, you know, doing this with you, it's a great time to get together with somebody to do these activities. Some of them are field trips. Some of them are actual, you know, hands-on things that we don't generally think to do with children this age, but it makes it interesting to do that for. And then there are evaluations, and the evaluations are tests. And I really think, in particular for homeschoolers, and I have homeschooled, so I can put myself in this category, it is critical that your children take tests. One of the things that happens to all of us as homeschoolers is we don't, our children aren't held accountable. And it's very easy to think, oh, well, they just got it, and we had this nice discussion. But one day, many of you want your children to go to a university. And I can tell you, they're going to walk in there on the first day and they're going to be held real accountable. And if they haven't learned how to take tests and they haven't had to study for them, I can tell you the times we've homeschooled versus the times my children are in school, when my children know they have a test on Friday, they study. When we're homeschooling, if I don't use an evaluation tool and they don't know they have a test that has a consequence behind it, the ante's not quite up here. Now, we, you know, I always hope that I've inspired them enough that they don't need that tool there. But the bottom line is, it's human nature. If I have a deadline, if I know that I'm going to be here speaking today, I make myself prepare. And it's just, it's human nature. And I think that sometimes we fool ourselves into thinking that education is just these warm fuzzies and we're going to sit around and we're going to talk about all this stuff and it's just going to be great. I've done that many times, but the great isn't always as great as when I put a deadline. Dads, look at the test. I can tell you for my boys, you know, I hear girls are really different. There's a whole lot of difference if dad looks at that test than if it's just me looking at the test. It just ups the ante on it. And encourage them with that too. I'm sounding, you know, like I'm real serious here. You know, I used to do things where, you know, if they did really, really well on that test, we would go on a field trip they wanted to go to or do something fun. Don't make it all, it's not all about discipline. It is about inspiring. And I think that's basically the coverage of that. You can ask questions later about specifics.
She really can be a tough woman.
Continuing on, there are I don't know if you haven't seen the book, you see in it that there are the classes, the discussion classes follow a certain format, recitation follows a certain format, and they're all very different, trying to intersperse them to create some variety and encourage variety. There may be other things that you would think of and be encouraged to do that, but the point we're trying to do is just make it possible for you who have not been familiar with all these works to be able to teach them. That's really what we're after, and to teach them with wisdom and godly thinking, with a biblical worldview. Because we have been, most of us have been educated to think that there isn't any biblical worldview thinking in a book like Herodotus or a book like Livy or a book like the Odyssey. And what we've tried to do is find people who really have studied that stuff to write those essays about that, to be able to help us make those connections. There are several stages of proofreading in this process, and I'm one of them. And I can't tell you how much I have learned and made connections for just reading through this stuff and doing that. It is really remarkable what some of these guys have written. Well, as I mentioned that we're dealing with 7th, 8th, and 9th, Omnibus 1, 2, and 3. Omnibus 1 covers the ancient time period, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, biblical days. Then we have the medieval time frame, which really starts, off the top of my head, I'm not sure I'm going to get this right, but it's probably around Augustine coming up to just shy of the... It might include the Reformation. It might go to about the Council of Trent. Is that right? and then the final stage is a modern time period. So we're running through the history for all of that. Now, we're trying to keep in balance the study of history, theology, and literature, and to not just bury the student in some really difficult work. So you'll find things that don't fit in that time frame a little bit, somewhat. And I haven't gone through the whole model of the omnibus, but it's set up with some primary works and some secondary works. And the primary works are given 5 days a week in our expectation and our planning in the book. And the secondary books are given 3 days a week. They're simply emphasized less. It doesn't mean that they're less important. Some of the biblical books are in there. It is our plan to go through history, that same cycle of that same time period, in books 4, 5, and 6 again, but it's our plan to try and throw other disciplines in there with it. So we'll have some aspects of math and science and maybe economics and all kinds of things show up in the second go-round. There'll be some different works. There'll be some reading of similar works. And something that we didn't plan at the onset, which looks like it's going to be possible now, and so we are now planning to do it, is to make sure that over the course of all 6 books, the entire Bible will have been studied. So we have studied in depth Omnibus 1 through 6 in that process. That's an exciting thing that we didn't think we could do originally and now are going to be able to accomplish. But what are the goals realized in doing all this? We think, narrowing it down, that what we're teaching is a unified understanding of God's creation and providence in all of these things, a connection to the past and a sense of what that might look in the future, looking at the trajectory, so that we can have an appreciation for the development of thoughts and ideas in the past both godly ones and ungodly, and look at that in the future. You know, you look at some of the ridiculous ideologies going around today with crystals and New Age thinking and stuff like that, and you find out that's not new stuff. That's not new stuff. The sad thing is the people that are practitioners and believers think it is. I mean, it's you know, and our kids need to know those kinds of things. We need to know. We need to be able to understand. We need to be able to engage with culture in order to be able to take it over, not to have a seat at the table, to have an even-handed discussion. I'm not looking for an even-handed discussion. I hope you're not either. This is Christ's world. He owns it. He died for it. He inherited it. And it's His, and we are His vice regents as we seek to see dominion spread throughout all the earth. And that's really the final thing. That is what we're ultimately after, is a real, enduring, deep godliness in our students. Questions? Is there a selection of read-alouds that you could pull from this because your children are too young to start it? The read-alouds would be, the answer is, much as it hurts me to say this, no. The history cards are in that category, and books like Black Ships Before Troy are the kind of books that you want for your kids in that. It's a retelling of one of the books being studied here. You know, it's that kind of thing that would make more sense. The thing that would make that would be good, though, is your kids are young. Get your head start going. Read the books yourself. It's possible. We wrote this so that you can do this without having read the books. But don't you think for a minute that that's ideal. It's doable, but it's not best. Oh, I think that would, yeah, there's some things that you could do, but I wouldn't read this. I would read the books.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of, the catalog is pretty clear about things that you'll be able to see. You'll probably have to draw the connections. But even a book like Herodotus has some great, funny side roads. I mean, I don't know about your kids, but my boys at the age of 6 would have loved to have heard stories of flying snakes. That kind of thing. Yeah, and I think it would be pretty easy for you to sit looking at the books which are listed in the catalog that are covered in Omnibus 1, looking at the grade level that your kids are at and a few years beyond it, and just drawing some connections there. And you could call our customer service people, and they could help you with that too. In the back. Well, that's a very good question. That's a very practical question. This book is the student book. This one for Omnibus 1. Omnibus 2 is slightly smaller. This book is about 600 pages. If we had printed the teacher's book, which has answers to everything being asked of a student in it, if there's a writing exercise being asked of the student, there's a writing exercise example. If there are questions, there are answers to those questions. If we had printed the teacher's manual like this, it would have been, I think, 1,200 pages, twice it. It's a computer CD it might be enhanced such that it can be used both ways. I don't think so. I think it's a computer CD. But what the short answer is, it's the teacher's edition. The CD is the teacher's edition. You will not want to do this with just the student edition. Yes. The question is, because the kids are past what we recommend age-wise, would you just do that this with them? Absolutely. That is a very common practice, and I would start with Omnibus 1 for two reasons. I might answer that question differently if I had an Omnibus 4 book in print, but I don't. And doing Omnibus 1 as opposed to doing nothing would be exceptional. And there's nothing particularly seventh grade about this book. It can be used at any level beginning with seventh grade. This is the kind of book, I enjoy doing this for the learning that I get out of it myself. Yes?
A similar question. Are you cycling back to the ancient time period with Omnibus?
Yes.
And then
Ancient medieval modern, ancient medieval modern, slightly different books, additional disciplines.
How do you foresee, and I know it's not in print yet and it's not done yet, it's probably in your mind but not even fully conceived, but what distinctions do you see would be, what you would be thinking at a high school level, number four, versus what you see, number one?
The question is, what distinctions do we see happening in 4, 5, and 6 versus 1, 2, and 3? I'm going to have to defer that answer because anything that I say will likely change come this November. What we did in planning this was we got Ty Fisher and his wife Emily together with Doug and Nancy Wilson. We went and holed up down at Colonial Williamsburg for, I think, 3 days to really do some brainstorming and thinking about how we wanted to do this. That's before anybody wrote anything. And we've decided that that's a valuable thing for us to do again before we jump into 4, 5, and 6. And so we're planning to do a similar retreat before advancing, to use the term in an equivocating way. Go ahead.
1, 2, and 3 equal in difficulty.
Yes, 1, 2, and 3 are equal in difficulty. And it wouldn't be necessary to do 1 before 2. There'll be a couple allusions to things that might have been covered in 1, in 2 or 3, and 3 for 2 and 1, but not enough to worry about. And so if you said, you know, I just finished doing ancient stuff with my kid and I want to jump into the omnibus, I don't want to do that again. Go to 2. Go to 3. They don't have to be done in order. Naturally, it makes the most sense to do history in order, but there are other reasons why you might not. Exactly. Yeah. I think we may have something printable on the teacher's CD. I'm not sure about that, but one of the things that I would do if I were teaching it at home is I would take the history cards, find a long hallway or a room that was a little bit obscure because I don't think that much of our history cards, and I want it in the living room, and put them in sequence and start to have them connect things that way. That's one of the things that I think would help in a transition from grammar to dialectic that I talked about the last hour. Yeah, and there are, you'll see at the end of the essays, at the beginning of each chapter, it tells you what cards connect. Yes? The question is it not more common to think of the great books as a rhetoric stage thing and beyond? Historically, there may be some argument that could be made there, but again, going back to this statement, that is that the dialectic stage and rhetoric stage are more connected than the grammar stage is to either of the other two, is one of the reasons. The other thing is because they're capable of it, but we are having a different expectation of a 7th grader than we are a 10th grader, and that's going to be seen in how the material is engaged with the young students. But you'll notice that we have the Odyssey in this, but not the Iliad. And that was a decision that we made based on a grammar, a dialectic stage versus rhetoric stage. We moved Thucydides into the second series, and there, in the 4, 5, and 6, or I guess it'd be 4. And so there's some things like that where we're making decisions about some books that are too tough, subject matter inappropriate, or whatever it is for that age level. So we've said some can be handled, some can't.
One of the things I think too, if we look historically, that we need to understand is that children grew up with these tales as their best friend. You know, they heard Homer. A lot of these things were not meant to be read. They were meant to be told out loud. And unfortunately, that's not how it's done anymore. But your hope and our desire is that these books will become their good friends, you know. And so the more they read them and interact with them, just like we read the children's Homer in third grade, they read Beowulf, they read some of these things in a children's version, our hope is that it will become something that is their best friend, not just, you know, and that's one reason for the repetition.
Those things that give those younger students the timeline so that when they get to that age, so much of the foundational work has been laid for them, and they're now saying, I mean, I remember my daughter looking through the catalog and saying, oh, I get it. So when I get to seventh grade, I get to read what that guy wrote, and in elementary school, I just learned about him.
Yeah.
And so for those with elementary students...
That's a wonderful connection. I want to try and summarize that for the tape, but basically, having come up in the system, they're able to make those connections, and they're more ready. And I think that's true also, and that's one of the things we want to try and prepare students every step of the way. Yes?
When it says reading assignment, it says book 1-94, is that a separate book?
Yes. Yeah. This is a textbook that is a tool for teaching the books that are covered chapter by chapter. But the book Herodotus is not, the text of Herodotus is not in here. That's correct. And that's true of all the books. The book Genesis is also being studied in this book. The Bible is not repeated in this book. Every book, none of the books that are being read and studied have the text of them within this book. Can you generate a list of the titles? Well, you could do it off the teacher's CD. You could also do it by looking at the table of contents. And you can also do it by looking at a Veritas Press catalog, which has them all listed as a group. But here is the table of contents. And if you photocopied that page, it would give you every single book. Now, we hope that, yeah, you could photocopy that and take it to the library with you. We love to sell you those books, but we understand that that's an enormous investment in books, and you may not want to have all of those. On the other hand, think about what you're doing creating a library for your child with books that he's read. So you've got some things, but it's an economic consideration, and this is an expensive process. I understand that. One of the things you need to be aware of is there are different editions, different versions. We make it clear which one we use, but we try when we have citations, like the 1-94 that you mentioned, to not use page numbers. Now, in Omnibus 3, which we're in the process of, we're in the early stages of editing, we have found that there are some books that, I can't think, there are two of them in particular, that they don't have chapter divisions, they don't have anything. And so we're left with, what do we do? And we're forced to use page numbers. And the only thing that we know to do is if that goes out of print, we'll post on the website the new edition that we recommend and some other page number, some other way to get it, but it won't be in the book and it won't be right. There's nothing we can do about it in some instances. We've avoided it for every book so far, but now we have two that are an issue. One of them was Pilgrim's Progress. And literally, one of the things that repeats itself, without having chapter divisions, is notes in the side of the page. And so we're referring to those notes as knowing stopping and starting points of where our answers are. But it was the only thing we could do. Another book, which is the letter written by, I can't think of it. It's one of the guys interacting with the Founding Fathers. No, it's not the Federalist Papers. But anyway, it's another book. And it's a letter, and it has no divisions whatsoever over the course of 150 pages. So you get page numbers, and if the edition goes out of print, look to the website. There's nothing we can do. Oh, I hate questions like that. The question is, when will number three be ready? Well, I lied about Omnibus 1. I lied about Omnibus 2. Do you really think I'm going to tell you the truth about Omnibus 3? Well, do your best is exactly right. I didn't lie intentionally. I just didn't meet my word. We have a production schedule that we are slightly behind on presently, that I think we can make up the ground that would have us shipping it in early August. That look means, I really hope we do that, because there's nothing I hate more than not, I really don't like living up to my word, and I really like establishing goals for myself, but this idea of public goals like this is driving me nuts sometimes. The book is intended to be a one-year book. The question is, what about pace and how long it would take? The book is intended to be a one-year book. And what I would recommend you do is, rather than start at the beginning and go to the end, is I would monitor my time through the process, and I would look for things that I needed to add in or cut, depending on where I was in relation to the book. But I said a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because we literally try and provide an optional session, an optional class, for every week of class. So if we're covering something over 3 weeks, we're giving you, and let's say it's primary, so you have 15 sessions for that work. We're also trying to give you three, one for every week, optional sessions also, or one for every five, because in second year I think it's still one for every five. Now, in some, when it's Herodotus, which I think is actually 6 weeks, we may not have given six optional sessions, but what we're trying to do is give some so you can substitute them out. So you want to be looking at those to see if there's something you'd rather do than the ones that are there. But in all seriousness, I would rather you get finished with the book and skip things than I would drag it down over a year and a half. Because I think that the student will be better off for having covered more material less deeply than getting bogged down and doing everything.
I was speaking with somebody earlier, and it wasn't even somebody at this conference. It was last week, and they said, well, you know, we skipped a bunch of books. And so I just said, oh, okay, that's great. What'd you skip? Well, what they had done was they had done all the secondary books and only two or three of the primary. If you're going to cut the secondary books, not the primary, because the secondary books are definitely easier to read, and they aren't going to give you the breadth of the year that you're going to get. So, you know, if you're going to cut, the place to cut is secondary books.
I don't mean this to sound as contradicting my wife, and I don't think you'll see it as that, but I would look at all of them very wisely. I don't want you to think that the secondary books are secondary in importance, and that's not what she meant you to hear. I know that. But it is true that what you want to do is really realize that those primary books tend to be the books that have demonstrated themselves to be the most ageless in many instances. But a Bible book, of course, is not in that category. Dorothy Sayers' Mystery is not as important. Yeah, that kind of thing is important. Any other questions? Well, then I have one question for you. My wife's birthday, I won't put the year on it, is June 17. Now, I'm going to give this book to the person whose birth date is the closest to that without going past it. What's your birthday?
June 22nd.
You're past it. Uh-oh. Are you closer than the 13th? Come get it. I was really worried that might go to somebody who's already had one or didn't have any use for it, and I'm glad that it's going to be used there. Having seen no other hands for other questions, let's go get some lunch.